we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right, no Maria this morning. She's
she's out not feeling well. Not feeling so well, we hope so. She feels better soon.
We do.
Because, you know, we're just those kind of people.
We are. So, starting out with local.
And besides, otherwise she'd hurt us. So
yeah, we won. We aren't going to have that happen. Starting out with local and a special session that legislature is having down in Olympia.
Yeah, and mostly what happened in Olympia this week, not a whole lot of progress in the special session itself in terms of the various committees meeting and whatnot and trying to figure out a way to close the massive gap in the 2011 budget. Now, mind you, they still have to turn around, 2012 budget, excuse me. They still have to turn around and get the subsequent biennial budget that starts in July, I believe, done in the regular session that will start in January. But in the meantime, this month they have to bridge a gap of a couple billion dollars. And a lot of different protests in Olympia this week to try and encourage state lawmakers, particularly Democrats, to grow a pair, as it were, and to consider some. Consider some revenue increases, as it were, rather than simply budget cuts to social services and essential infrastructure that already, frankly, have been cut to and beyond the bone. So you had unions down there protesting. You had university students down there protesting. You had a whole bunch of folks down there, including a couple of attempts to occupy the Capitol building itself on Monday and Tuesday. But I wanted to give a special shout out on Wednesday to 400 Garfield High School students, as well as some sprinkling of students from other high schools around the city, that walked out and walked down or marched down to City Hall, not because they had a beef with City Hall, but as an encouragement to the city to in turn encourage the state not to cut further to the funds to K-12 education, which has already taken an enormous hit over the past few years. And to his credit, Mayor McGinn came out and talked to the high school students. Now, there were no adults present in this protest. This was strictly something that was organized by and for high school students, and it was very instructive to read the comments in the in our local daily paper from people who are saying, oh, they're just trying to skip out of class and whatnot. No, these are students learning how to participate in our democratic process, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. And so props to them, and I hope they keep doing it until they get full funding for education, because they deserve it.
All right. Moving on, Governor Christine Gregoire with a petition.
Yeah, she and Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee, who is a Republican, wrote a letter this week asking the federal DEA to reschedule medical marijuana as a Schedule II drug rather than its current, I believe it's Schedule I status, which is, no medical use whatsoever, extremely addictive, extremely harmful. This will kill you, which, you know, both science and experience and common sense suggests is kind of ridiculous. Schedule II is still problematic. It would put it in the same classification as cocaine and morphine and some other drugs that do have medical uses, even though they're highly addictive and very dangerous in terms of the capacity to overdose on them. Whereas it's just in the medical literature, you don't find people overdosing on pot. That being said, the letter probably will not actually have much of an effect on the DEA. It's not like the DEA is going to hold a public hearing on this or actually do the rescheduling, but it gives some political cover to Christine Gregoire after she and also Chafee in Rhode Island vetoed legislation that would have regulated our respective states' medical marijuana dispensary systems this past year. But at least a dozen other states have gone ahead and ignored the federal threats to prosecute state workers who are involved in the distribution of medical marijuana. And that's really what Gregoire should be doing also. I mean, she's trying to give herself some political cover on this, but what she really needs to do is just go ahead and again, show some political courage, as she should be showing some political courage on the willingness to raise state revenues. she should be showing some political courage and enabling people who legitimately do need medical marijuana for their various health issues to be able to obtain it without risking prosecution, frankly, because that's the status quo right now.
All right. Moving on, a couple judicial rulings this week.
Yeah, let's start with Thurston County, where a judge ruled yesterday that Seattle Central Community College can evict Occupy Seattle. This was not a surprise at all. I mean, it's you know, kind of a no-brainer that a state institution that controls a piece of land has the right to say somebody is trespassing on that land. And that's essentially what the trustees of Seattle Central did by banning camping and saying that, you know, people who camped on the land would be eligible to be kicked off that land. So it was really done, I think, more as a delaying tactic than anything else to give Occupy Seattle a chance to find some alternative space. They've now got until next Thursday because there will be a 3-day grace period for after formal notification, which will happen on Monday because the court ruling came at close of business yesterday. But it really does make you wonder strategically why Occupy Seattle pursued this court case to begin with. I mean, granted, it gave them this additional media. It gave them this a delaying tactic. But it also, I mean, what's the message that you're sending out by occupying an institution of higher learning if it does not want you there? And if the students do not want you there, which is at least a substantial chunk of students there have in fact been complaining about the mess and the sanitary conditions and drug use and some of the other complaints that have come with not just Occupy Seattle but Occupy encampments around the country. You know, what message are you sending out by going into an adversarial relationship with students and with an institution of higher learning where you want that institution to be getting more funding? And that's part of your message, is that, you know, the 99% deserve access to higher education, not just McJobs. And so, it seems to me it would have been much more graceful and a much better bridge building gesture if at the point where Seattle Central had said, you know, would you please leave, if they had simply said, well, give us some time, let's work it out, like, we need to find a place to go, and then we'll do this, you know, cooperatively, and we'll work something out with you, as opposed to going to court for it. So I was a little surprised by that.
All right. There's also a decision involving the Washington State Department of Ecology.
Yeah, this was better news, actually. The U.S. District Court Judge Marsha Peckman ruled yesterday that the State Department of Ecology has to enforce the 1995 EPA greenhouse gas emission standards against the state's 5 oil refineries. Now, those standards have been on the books for the last 16 years, and the state DOE has not enforced them, not under Gary Locke and not under Christine Gregoire. Really kind of very good news, actually, that the U.S. District Judge essentially is saying it's not enough for the State Department of Ecology to say, well, we're going to wait for the federal government to take action on greenhouse gas emissions. The states themselves have a responsibility to enforce these standards. And that presumably would have application to other states as well, since this was a district court judge ruling. So that covers certainly the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, not just Washington, but other Western states. But certainly for Washington State, it means that the various oil refineries, like the one up at Anacortes, need to be regulated in terms of the greenhouse gases that they put into the air. And this is not something that the state has been doing to date.
Have you got an impression of why the state hasn't been doing that?
Well, as I said, they have not been doing it because they've said this is a federal responsibility. You know, the feds have the money to do this. We don't have the money. So they've basically been waiting for the feds to take action and adopt standards. And,
gotcha.
That's obviously for political reasons not going to happen anytime soon. So the states need to go ahead and take action.
All right.
And, props, by the way, to Earth Justice, who is the outfit that brought the lawsuit. They do great work.
They do. All right. Moving on to national and, the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, a report in Bloomberg News this week that the Fed did not tell Congress in 2008 and early 2009 that it loaned $7.77 trillion to two big-to-fail banks. Now, $13 billion in bank profits were resulted from that, from the below-market-rate loans, which The banks then turned around and flipped with market rate loans using that same money, up to $1.2 trillion that was loaned on a single day, that being December 5th, 2008, 3 years ago, Monday. So this dwarfs the actual $700 billion bailout that was so controversial that people on both the left and right were opposed to in the final days of the Bush administration, and then subsequent bailouts that happened early in the Obama administration. This is much, much larger than that, and it points us back to another issue, which is the lack of transparency in the Fed. Congressional hearings had been held in 2009 and 2010 in which the Fed was refusing to say whether it had made such loans or not, and so the Congress was actually kept in the dark about this, or at least publicly they were kept in the dark. And there was no transparency and there was no accountability to the public. And, given the amount of money is involved, dwarf the amount of money in the public bailout that happened in 2008, 2009. This is something that should have gotten a lot more attention this week.
Yeah, and good job for Bloomberg News for pursuing that through Freedom Information Act requests.
They've been
pretty dogged on that one. So.
Yeah. And sharply critical of the Fed, even though Bloomberg News is obviously a very pro-business publication.
Yeah. So some investigative journalism still going out there on occasion.
Imagine that.
All right. So talk about the SEC and Citigroup.
Really? Yeah, it was a bad week all around for Wall Street in terms of publicity. A federal judge, Jed Rakoff in Manhattan, rejected the Securities and Exchange Commission deal with Citigroup this week. The SEC has routinely been settling cases with big banks like Citigroup. In this case, they gave them a $95 million fine with no admission of wrongdoing for some $700 million in fraud perpetrated by Citigroup. And this is, a fairly routine proposed settlement by the SEC, where the SEC and Citigroup then come before a judge and get the judge to sign off on it. Well, Judge Rakoff in this case, not only did not sign off on it, but he blasted the entire practice, saying that essentially became a cost of doing business, where big banks figured, well, we can perpetrate this enormous fraud, we'll pay this little bit of a fine, and really the SEC's only role in this is to skim a little bit of money off the top of the crime. So really kind of a blistering 15-page decision. I would encourage people to go online and find it out. The lack of transparency was something that Rakoff also strongly criticized in these settlements. What happens, again, if you can imagine this in a criminal case where, say, I go and kill somebody, and then my lawyer and the prosecutor go and make a deal where we go before the judge and say, we're not going to admit wrongdoing. In fact, we're not even going to tell the judge what the crime was. We just want to pay a fine. You can't imagine that kind of situation in a criminal case, but this is exactly what's been going on for many years in terms of Wall Street white-collar crime. And Rakoff is saying, you know, not only is this extraordinarily unethical, it violates all kinds of procedures and laws, it's also unconstitutional, and the public has a right to know, and the public also has a right to have public interest considered in what these settlements are. The SEC was literally arguing that public interest should not be a consideration in deciding what the settlement terms are. So presumably the banks will appeal this as a precedent and go shopping for other judges who will be more sympathetic. But at least in that particular lower Manhattan courtroom, a precedent has now been set that this kind of settlement is just not acceptable.
Shopping for judges. Is that,
yeah, you can do it online, actually, from what I understand.
And with the holidays coming up, I understand there's going to be some sales. So
yeah, there's you enter in a promotion code.
All right.
I believe they're called campaign contributions.
All right, moving on. The Senate was busy this week.
Yeah, Senate Republicans blocking a payroll tax cut extension that would have been paid for by a surcharge on millionaires. Now this is interesting because Republican framing on the expiration of tax cuts like this has been that it constitutes a tax increase. So by the Republicans' own framing, what they have done here is to cause a tax increase on a vast swath of the American middle class that was receiving that payroll tax cut. The Obama administration wanting to pay for it by, putting a surcharge on the 1%, actually on a smaller percentage than that, but on millionaires. And above and beyond that, the Republicans counterproposing a smaller cut that would be paid for by federal jobs loss. Now think about this, because the whole purpose of doing a payroll tax cut in the first place is to stimulate the economy, and particularly to stimulate the economy at a time when demand is down, and demand being down because unemployment is high, and people who do have jobs, often they're underemployed or they're part-time jobs, or they don't have enough money to make ends meet, so they're not buying as much. So you're going to stimulate the economy by a payroll tax cut that's paid for by putting more people out of work. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense economically, but the Republicans would rather pursue that than have tax on sacrosanct millionaires. So the Republicans moved in the Senate this week to increase taxes on the middle class. They also moved this week to kill a number of amendments to the defense authorization bill. Rand Paul, the Libertarian senator from Kentucky, put in an amendment to repeal the 2003 Iraq authorization to use military force. It only got 30 votes in the Senate, even though we're now leaving Iraq, and presumably that war is over. A Udall amendment to ban the detention of U.S. citizens only got 37 votes out of the 100 members of the Senate. The provisions of that of the defense authorization bill that were problematic that Udall was trying to address: number one, mandates the suspected terrorists can be held by the military, including U.S. citizens being able to be held by the military with no due process and no trials in civilian courts. Secondly, it expanded the 2001 post 9/11 authorization to use military force that authorized the war on terror to include not just Al Qaeda and the Taliban, but quote, associated forces, again at a time when presumably President Obama is drawing down troops in Afghanistan and Al Qaeda is, according to the U.S. government, again all but non-functional in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Osama bin Laden is dead, etc., etc. This is an endorsement by Congress of expanding the war on terror and really, for all intents and purposes, making it permanent and saying that, you know, 10 years after 9/11, we have no intent, not on just not winding down the war on terror, but on we want to instead institutionalize it as something that will be with us forever. And then finally, it put further bans on something Congress has already banned, which is transferring prisoners out of Guantanamo Bay, the prison in Cuba. So these were a number of problematic positions. Now, Obama actually wound up vetoing this bill, but it wasn't because of the problematic nature of these provisions. It was because he wanted the executive branch to have authority over making these decisions about things like military rather than civilian detention of suspected terrorists. And so in order to have executive branch rule over that rather than congressional rule over it, he actually vetoed that bill. So for the time being, the status quo is only the Patriot Act and only the 2001 authorization to use military force. But again, this precedent has been set where Congress is really pushing for an expansion of that. And all Republicans, but also quite a few Democrats, voted in favor of this.
And our two local senators
voted against. They were on the right side on this one, happily. But a number of Democratic senators were not.
And as you had pointed out last week, the number of what the military considers targets in Pakistan has dropped dramatically.
Yeah, we literally now have targets, we now have actually two leaders of Al Qaeda that remain in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Actually, none in Afghanistan and only two in Pakistan. Everybody else has been killed or assassinated, literally, by the drones. And by the targeted bombings. Nonetheless, the military and now Congress are also saying we still need to keep doing this. We need to keep expanding it, even though the people who are getting killed by this, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes, are at this point largely people who shouldn't be targeted in the first place.
All right. Moving on, a Pew survey out this week or recently.
Yeah, Pew survey coming out showing that in congressional districts represented by Tea Party lawmakers, the number of people saying they disagree with the Tea Party has gone up substantially since the midterms a year ago. Now, almost as many people disagree with it, this in heavily Republican districts, as agree with it. In Tea Party districts, 23% now disagree with the Tea Party and 25% agree. A year ago, that was 18% disagreed and 33% agreed. In another poll in the Pew analysis in October, 48% in Tea Party districts said they had a negative view of Republicans and 41 favorable. That favorable has dropped 14 percentage points since March. And that drop was actually steeper among people who know the Tea Party best than it was amongst the general public, which, you know, sort of backs up anecdotally what we've seen in states like Wisconsin and Florida and Ohio, where you've had Tea Party governors trying to do outrageous things. The percentage with a favorable opinion of Republicans has fallen to 36% from 42 in March, while the number who disagree with the Tea Party has also risen among the general public to now about 27% disagreed and 20% agreed, as opposed to a year ago, 27 and 22 agree versus disagree. So what all of those numbers mean basically is that the people who have seen how the Tea Party actually governs, the people who have been represented by the Tea Party in Congress, are getting really alienated by it. And this has real implications for the Republican presidential nomination. For instance, as weak as Mitt Romney is among the Republican base, enthusiasm for Tea Party candidates is also now going down. So that would be an advantage for the moneyed wing of the Republican Party, which would very much like to see somebody like Romney nominated. But it also means that it's much more difficult to get independent votes in a general election for a Tea Party type candidate. So hopefully we'll see a different pattern. Now, whether that pattern will favor Democrats or not is anybody's guess, but at least it's a strike against people who are totally detached from reality being put in positions of high power.
All right, I guess we'll
not wait, that there isn't still a demand for that.
Sure, there's a channel for that. All right,
yeah, more than it's called Fox News. Yeah,
let's move on to international and starting with Iraq.
Yeah, milestone on I believe it was Thursday or Friday. The U.S. military handed over control of the Victory base complex to Iraq. Now that's basically been the command center of the United States military presence in Iraq since about the time of the fall of Baghdad in 2003, and was one of the huge mega bases that people were very concerned about in the middle of last decade that the U.S. was building with, you know, Burger Kings and Subway restaurants and golf courses and so forth as a small American city. All that's now been handed over to the government of Iraq. So it took many years too long, but a good milestone that really wasn't much noted in the media. The Obama administration not making a big deal about this at all, because probably they're afraid of being accused of cutting and running. But it's good news. It's good news that the U.S. is getting out and is on pace to get out entirely by the end of the year.
Yeah, you would have thought that would have garnered front page headlines and, you know, top of the news mentions, but all right, well, let's
no Herman Cain had an affair, that was bigger news,
garnered news headlines. Let's move on. Egypt.
Yeah, Egypt had elections this week, parliamentary elections, and a result that was discouraging to many in the United States, which is that the Islamists won a solid majority of the votes there. The Muslim Brotherhood and allied parties won about 40% of the vote. Salafis, which are more conservative Islamists, won another 25% of the vote, and liberals didn't do particularly very well at all. Now, this has some kind of interesting implications for the Occupy movement, which has all along modeled itself quite a bit on the Arab Spring, because what happened with the Egyptian elections was that the organizations that had infrastructure, in this case the religious organizations that had not a church but a mosque infrastructure, and an organization as opposed to just people coming together and camping out in the square who hadn't worked with each other before, didn't have a command structure, didn't didn't really know how to work with each other until just a few months ago. The folks who had worked with each other, who had a presence in a number of different communities and knew how to mobilize that presence, those are the folks who did well in elections. And what it tells you about the Occupy movement is that same thing. If they don't get involved in electoral politics, if they don't get involved in grassroots organizing in the community and keep it going on an ongoing basis, that the passion and the energy that has been mobilized by the Occupy movement is not going to translate into political power. That basically is in a very oversimplified nutshell is a lot of what's happening in Egypt right now. And people who were not part of the original mobilization or were ancillary to the original mobilization are reaping the political benefits of that mobilization because the folks who actually mobilized couldn't translate that quickly enough into actual political power. And so it's an object lesson for people who are trying to do the same thing here.
All right. Syria, briefly?
Yeah. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, talking about Syria this week, heading for civil war. A defector group, soldier defector group called the Free Syria Army is now launching attacks on military installation. Now, over the last 9 months, some 4,000 people have been killed in Syria, including 340 children and 14,000 prisoners have been taken by the Syrian government as well. So a lot of people now talking at the UN level about the need for foreign intervention to head off a civil war in Syria. So keep that on your radar as something that may follow the Libya model in the next couple months.
All right. And then finally, Pakistan.
Yeah, 28 soldiers being killed in Pakistan by a NATO bombing on Saturday. That got a lot of headlines in the United States, particularly because Pakistan retaliated by cutting off Afghan supply routes for the U.S. Armed Forces. But what did not get a lot of headlines was something that happened a couple of days earlier when seven Afghan civilians, including six children, were killed in a NATO bombing. Once again, a whole lot of civilians being killed in Afghanistan by NATO and U.S. bombing. But what you got on U.S. media that was U.S. soldiers having Thanksgiving dinner. And it was really kind of a telling set of priorities in terms of U.S. media coverage.
Mm. And again, this is, you know, pretty much standard operating procedure of what is happening in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
It is, and you know, it happening to no particular end because, as we talked about earlier, the actual targets that were the reason for starting this war in the first place a decade ago have all gone away at this point. You know, Al-Qaeda no longer really has a presence there.
All right, events.
Couple of events to talk about. One that was moved from earlier this week, Saturday from 10 o'clock until noon, that is coming up in about an hour, an interfaith discussion with Occupy Seattle. Author Paul Loeb will be moderating that. That'll be held at Plymouth United Church of Christ at 1217 6th Avenue downtown. And then coming up next weekend, Friday night and then all day on Saturday, starting Friday from 6 to 9 p.m., and then also Saturday from 8:30 to 4, the Seattle Race Initiative, which I believe is an annual event that happens, will be going on at Mount Zion Baptist Church at 1634 19th Avenue, just off Madison. So check that out. They do have an amazing conversation about race and race-related issues every year.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org, a website with news, commentary, tips, humor, whatever we can think of. We throw it on there.